Thank you, Mr. Smith. And I'll also say a good afternoon to all of you. Now, Mr. Weber advised me that there are guests here and visitors, and so not to embarrass myself nor the rest of the church, but I do appreciate very much the opportunity in coming down. We were in trumpets in Garden Grove last week, and during the offertory they also had flute and violin, well, flute and horn. And one of the flutists was my wife. And I said that I was very taken by the offertory music, and especially one of the flutists. Now, if I said that today, I'd be in an awful, awful lot of trouble. But I do want to thank you very much for the lovely music. Well, this is an exciting time. This is the most concentrated time period for Holy Days. We are right in the middle of it. Trumpets, as you may know, which we just celebrated last week, is the pivot point for all the Holy Days. There's three before trumpets and then three after. And this is, as was brought out in the first message, this is an interesting one because it's a feast day, but we fast on this day. I can only imagine with the facilities that we're in, they see us for part of the year celebrating potlucks and coffee. And then there's a period of time where we don't bring any bread in. They think, what's up with that? And then on today, we don't eat. So I can only imagine what the owners of our buildings think about what we believe. But we know what we believe. In fact, I wanted to make a comment. What a beautiful building. How long before you get thrown out of this one? No, I know this. We've been here many, many times, and it's nice because it's a little closer to where we live. We live in Orange County, but we serve in the Pasadena Eagle Rock area. But no, I like what you've done with the place. I asked Mr. Smith what all the black squares meant. He said, to deaden your voice. No, he didn't say that. He didn't say that. But I find it fascinating. You keep finding churches that have holy drum sets. Why has it got its own little kind of tabernacle around it? The last place you were at had a tabernacle, didn't it, around it? Yeah. I don't want to know the reason. It wouldn't make any sense. But today is a double Sabbath, is it not? It is the Saturday Sabbath, the weekly Sabbath. And it was pointed out, there's a section of Leviticus. This is a Sabbath of Sabbaths, a Sabbath Sabbaton. And it's interesting that one of the verses or sections we're going to look at today, Leviticus chapter 16, and if you'd turn there, please, it is the most extensive, the most detailed explanation of any holy day. And so, as we do today, we celebrate this very important day with all our headaches and my throat ready to go. I tell you, last night I stayed up all night, and I think I found the solution. In the book of Malezekiel, there is a section where it says, thou shalt take caffeine in moderation on atonement. I don't quite have the verse memorized, but I'm going to go back and find it. But as we celebrate this day, I'd like us to look at this day in three phases or perspectives, plus one. As it relates to the high priest, the Israelites, and all their successors. And in fact, we'll add some nuances of Perry Mason along the way. And I know what you're thinking right now. How in the world is he going to wedge Perry Mason in this? I'll find a way. But as we read this, I want us to go back in time. It is the 15th century BCE. The Exodus is behind us. We are with Moses, and we are the Israelites in the wilderness. Now, but as we read this, and we take ourselves back in time in this chapter, I want us to remember there's two contexts that we always look at the Old Testament with. Two minimally. One context is that this is a historical event. We believe that these are real people. These are real events. They lived real flesh and blood lives. But there's also what we'll call maybe the religious or the Christian context. And that's because you are here. You're not Jews. worshiping in the synagogue on Sabbath. But you're Christians. And so we have both a historical context and we have a Christian context. So when we read these verses, we know exactly what they mean or should mean. But it's important that we also go over them from time to time. And if not now, then when? So we are back in time. And I want you to start with me on this very special Sabbath. In fact, this technically is a trifecta Sabbath. I know it's a racetrack term. I don't go to the racetrack, but everybody knows what trifecta means. It's a Sabbath of Sabbaths, and it's on a Sabbath. So it has that added importance or specialness to it. Today we have no work. Nada, nothing, nine, no way. That's why you took the day off. You would have taken this day off if it hadn't been the Sabbath. Because we, as we shall see, we are commanded not to work. But indeed, we're going to read about someone who works furiously on this day. Probably more so in his particular job than he does any other time during the year. Holy day, Sabbath, regular weekday. It's a tremendous amount of work. For this person to do their job, they must prepare themselves physically and emotionally as no other day. So let's begin in Leviticus chapter 16. Verse 1. Now the Eternal spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, when they offered profane fire, and that word is added, but it's implied, when they had offered profane fire before the Eternal, and they died. And the Eternal said to Moses, tell Aaron your brother not to come at just any time into the holy place, inside the veil, before the mercy seat which is on the ark, lest he die. For I will appear in the cloud above the mercy seat. Now, this is already off to a rather odd start. It recounts what occurred in chapter 10. So if you'll go back there, hold your hand in Leviticus 16 and go back to Leviticus 10, we need to pick up the story. Leviticus 10 begins with not a happy event. I want you to remember who Aaron is. He is the high priest. He is God's chosen. But we're going to read about something that happened to his family. Chapter 10, verse 1, then Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer and put fire in it, put incense on it, and offered profane fire before the Eternal, which he had not commanded them. Now, let's set the picture. The high priest is by order of paternal succession. In other words, if your father was the high priest, and you're the only male son, if you were a son, you'd be male. But if you're the only male, you would be the high priest. And so there is a religious connotation of being related to the high priest. And so his two sons took censers and offered fire, profane fire, strange fire, which God had not commanded them. Verse 2. So fire went out from the Eternal and devoured them, and they died before the Eternal. And Moses said to Aaron, this is what the Eternal spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy. And before all people, I must be glorified. So Aaron held his peace. These are real people, real events, and this man has just lost two sons. The fact that God did it probably didn't make it any easier, probably made it a whole lot worse. And so we go back to Leviticus chapter 16 now, with this as the backdrop, the background to this. So they offered strange fire. They offer fire. God says, you want fire? I'll give you fire. And he could kill them both right there at the altar. And so we can speculate what strange fire means. It just means different from what is expected. But they would set in motion the whole events of Leviticus chapter 16. They are not the reason, but they propel this forward. So it says, you shall not appear before me just any time. And you will not prepare before me in any way. There will be preparation, both in time and in place. And so that's, in just two quick verses, that is what Leviticus gives us. It will not be what you want, God says. It will be what I want. Because I will be there in the cloud. He will descend on the tabernacle in the wilderness behind the veil. So let's continue with that wonderful, positive, uplifting beginning to this Day of Atonement. Aaron is grieving. He had to have been grieving. Those of us that are parents would have some distant, hopefully not too concrete, concept of what he is going through. It says, thus Aaron shall come into the Holy of Holies, the holy place, with the blood of a young bull as a sin offering, and a ram as a burnt offering. He shall put on the holy linen tunic, the linen trousers on his body. He shall be girded with a linen sash, and with the linen turban he shall be attired. These are holy garments. Therefore he shall wash his body in water, and put them on. And he shall take from the congregation of the children of Israel 2 kids of the goats as a sin offering, and 1 ram as a burnt offering. So washings, special clothings, they to be plain, linen, cotton. They are not to be the official robes, the royal robes of his office as the high priest. It's simplicity in outward appearance. It's very, very plain. But he won't be going in alone. As we heard in the offertory, he would be bringing a gift, multiple gifts. He would be taking no chances. Now, I want you to think about what Aaron is going through as he goes in. He hears this, because it's the prelude. He's not going in alone. He's taking in the sacrifice of bulls and goats and a ram. So the first three verses, the first few verses, discuss major offerings, washings, special clothing. Because you see, you cannot just walk in and talk to God at any time, in any place. You must be prepared when you are prepared to go behind the veil. And so we continue. Verse 6, Aaron shall offer the bull as a sin offering, which is for himself, and make atonement for himself and for his house. He shall take the 2 goats and present them before the Eternal at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Now this is for Aaron, and it's for his house. House meaning family. And I want you to remember that verse later in this message, because it becomes very, very important in the historical development. So he does it for his house. He takes the 2 goats, presents them before the Eternal at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Verse 8. Then Aaron shall cast lots for the 2 goats, one for the Eternal and the other lot for the scapegoat, or Azazel, as it is in the original. And Aaron shall bring the goat in which the Eternal's lot fell and offer it as a sin offering, but the goat in which the lot fell to be the scapegoat, or Azazel, shall be presented alive before the Eternal to make atonement upon it and to let it go as the scapegoat into the wilderness. And there's a lot right there. Tremendous. It talks about the 2 goats. It talks about the bull. All of this. He said, you are not going to go in alone. Now I want you to think about this. Aaron, for he and his family, bring in a bull. Now in some translations it'll say young bull. It's still a bull. One guy. One dude. And his family. However, for a couple hundred thousand people, right? Maybe 1 million people by some estimates, right? They need 2 goats. 1 bull for the high priest, 2 goats for hundreds of thousands of people. Would that make Aaron feel good? Or not so good? Aaron, you need to bring in more, a bigger animal, because you're the high priest. I need more blood from you. I need a bigger animal. The blood to weight ratio must have been astronomical in the number of people involved. So he wasn't going to take any chances. No chances whatsoever. And so there is distinction in these 2 goats. One's for God, one isn't for God. And we'll get to that later. This is still part of the prelude. Because in verse 11, phase 1 begins. Verse 11, and Aaron shall bring the bull of the sin offering, which is for himself, and make atonement for himself and his house, and he shall kill the bull as the sin offering, which is for himself. You'll notice that God tells them, he tells them again, and then they do it in Leviticus 16. Verse 12, then he shall take a censer full of burning coals of fire from the altar before the Eternal. I'm wondering, as he did this, he's a human being, flesh and blood, just like you, just like me. The last time we read the word censer, it involved whom? His 2 sons. And so we can only imagine what went through Aaron's head, or his mind, or his heart at that time. And he shall put the incense on the fire before the Eternal, that the cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat that is on the testimony, lest he die. He shall take some of the blood of the bull and sprinkle it with his finger on the mercy seat on the east side. Before the mercy seat, he shall sprinkle some of the blood with his finger 7 times. So this is back to the bull for Aaron himself. This is intense. I want you to picture it. It's meant to conjure up the images of the words that are used. There is blood. There is the incense. How many of you have ever smelled incense? All right, for the 30 of you that haven't, or the 70 of you who haven't, there was a time in my life where in the 60s and 70s, no, I didn't do any of that. But we did have, everybody had to have incense. Incense is a pungent smell. It's meant to. But I want you to do a little bit of homework and look at how much incense Aaron had to grind and prepare and put to fire. The sense of the smell must have been overpowering. And it's right in the middle of his face. He has got blood around him. He's smoke around him. God is descending in a cloud. There's a lot going on. And all this time, Aaron knows he can't see God. He can barely see what he's doing. He's not meant to see much. Because if he does, he will see God, and no man can see God and die. The scene must have been unbelievable. And so all of this was done behind the veil in the Holy of Holies. And God is there. God is right there with him. Aaron is the high priest. He knows he has been chosen for this job, and he does it. Further, this is a Sabbath. No work is to be done. No work. What is he doing? He's doing nothing but work. He is sacrificing multiple animals, along with all the other duties that the high priest and the rest of the priesthood had to do this day. Aaron singly had to do all the work on the Day of Atonement. All this work, slaughtering multiple animals, preparing incense, lifting and measuring and sprinkling all the blood. By some counts, he sprinkles blood 43 times. And, by the way, as a reminder, as we were reminded in the first message, what else was Aaron doing? He was fasting. Now, I don't know how you feel right now, but this, if I don't get a headache today the size of Mount Rushmore, it'll be a good Day of Atonement. I drink way too much coffee, and I think of a Day of Atonement as basically 2 different days, along with all the other spiritual meaning. It's the day of God's low blood sugar and the day of no caffeine. It reminds me maybe I'm drinking a little bit too much coffee during the week. But in all seriousness, I couldn't do what he was doing, not fasting. Not with my mind elsewhere, not when I had just lost 2 sons. He was a real human being. And we see that he is offering this bull for he and his family. Phase 2 now begins, the first goat. Verse 15, and then he shall kill the goat of the sin offering, which is for the people. Bring its blood inside the veil. Do with the blood as he did with the blood of the bull, and sprinkle it for himself, and sprinkle it on the mercy seat and before the mercy seat. So he shall make atonement for the holy place because of the uncleanness of the children of Israel, and because of their transgressions for all their sins. And so he shall do for the tabernacle of meeting, which remains among them in the midst of their uncleanness. Look at the key words here. Aaron is again reminded what he had to do for himself and his family. And now with the goat, he's making atonement for the holy place because of the uncleanness of the children of Israel. He's in the midst, as it says in the end of verse 16, it's in the midst of their uncleanness. That's a negative. That's a bad thing. It's because of their sin. And so we see, whereas it recounts the actions of the high priest, Aaron, this action is for the people. The sanctuary had been defiled. Remember all those hundreds of thousands of people that we mentioned? They sinned. They sinned a lot. I mean, you've got a couple hundred thousand people. I don't know, 500,000 or 1 million, whatever number you wish. That's a lot of sinning. That's a lot of uncleanness. And so the sanctuary has to be cleaned. So there is this cleansing that is necessary. But the true reason at this point becomes a mystery. It's not spelled out. But there is goat's blood on the mercy seat. It's on it. It's before it. It's on the altar. Let's continue. Verse 17. There shall be no man in the tabernacle of meeting when he goes in to make atonement in the holy place until he comes out. Maybe he's thinking, if he comes out, that he may make atonement for himself. There's that reminder again. For his household, another reminder, and for all the assembly of Israel. And he shall go out to the altar that is before the eternal and make atonement for it. And he shall take some of the blood of the bull and some of the blood of the goat and put it on the horns of the altar all around. Then he shall sprinkle some of the blood on it with his finger 7 times, cleanse it, consecrate it from the uncleanness of the children of Israel. Now, this can seem fairly depressing. There's a lot of blood going on here. There's no doubt about it. It's repeated for us to read, not to dwell on it, not to get overwrought about it, but to understand it in both its historical context, which includes the spiritual, as well as the religious that we understand. I want you to think about this for a minute. I'm trying to picture a scene, and I'm not trying to over-dramatize it. When we go to the market, or when my wife goes to the market, and I'm allowed to go along with her, I always go to a certain section. She probably doesn't even know this. I go to where the meat is. And all the different meat and all the different fish, I can't eat. I think it's amazing how it's prepared and how it's laid out. And every once in a while, I'll see the butcher. He has on white clothing. Always. How many of you ever seen your local butcher? All right. There's some men that raise their hands. Y'all try it, guys. I look at the butcher. He's in white. It isn't clean. He's got a messy job. But he has instruments and protection. Far more than Aaron had. By the way, he's got a light over his head. He can see what he's doing. But it's a very messy, messy job. And so when we think of this, we also think of why it had to be done. And even as much as we've read so far today, for Aaron and the people, the day isn't over. Phase 3 commences with the second goat. Verse 20, and when he had made an end of atoning the holy place, the tabernacle of meeting, he shall bring the live goat. Aaron shall lay both his hands on the head of the live goat, confess over it all the iniquities of the children of Israel and all the transgressions concerning all their sins. Wow. All the iniquities, all their transgressions, all their sins. We got it. Putting them on the head of the goat, and shall send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a suitable man. The goat shall bear on itself all the iniquities, all their iniquities, to an uninhabited land, and he shall release the goat in the wilderness. So the third goat. The sins are said over the goat, the Azazel goat, the goat of departure, call it whatever you'd like. Traditionally, we have said that this represents Satan, and I believe that very much. His guilt, the blame belongs to him in great measure, and he and sin must be removed. And that's what is pictured on this day. I have another question. I want to know what was said. I want to know the words that were used. How specific was Aaron? Did he say that Ralph did these things? That Sally did these things? How long did it take? Imagine it was very moving because the people could hear it. They were there. They were wondering what was going on. They were intimately involved. They wanted the priest to do his job. This is important for them. This was done once a year. And we're talking about the first year, but it was done every year for many, many, many years. Why was all this necessary? Why was there all this ritual of clothing and washing and different animals and sacrifices and the scapegoat? Why? What is the point? Was it the need to appease an angry God? That's what Christianity's detractors say. You've got a very angry God here. He seems to be very upset. He seems to want these things done for him, or you can't talk to him. That could be said. The high priest's work, it all falls in this one high priest. You talk about stress on your job. Can you imagine the stress that Aaron went through on that very first atonement? Can you imagine the stress of doing it every year, the work that he had to do, how necessary it was to cleanse himself, to cleanse the people, and to cleanse the tabernacle of the sins. It was an incredibly important job. Now I want you to fast forward 1400 years. By the time of Christ, it had gotten worse. Much, much worse. It had changed dramatically. Once again, we look at the historical context, and the development of the historical context is critical. In fact, I think this time period, in my opinion, is so important. I believe that it is why, as you'll see, why the prophecies of time Christ's arrival to this particular period. Something was beginning, had begun to happen 100 to 200 years prior to Christ. There was the oral law, the rules and regulations that were rapidly developing in Judaism at the time. They wrote them down because the Mishnah tractate, as it's called, the tractate Yoma, sorry, and the Mishnah encapsulates what was going on at the time of Christ for the Day of Atonement and how it had developed. It's called the Commandments of Men. I have a copy of it here. It's the new translation by Jacob Neusner. This is the Mishnah. When we talk about the Talmud, it's the Mishnah and another additional or incorporated in 60 to 70 volumes. So just look at this book. I'll allow you to touch it and pick it up. You cannot read it. I'm kidding. But I'm going to quote from the Danby edition of the Mishnah because I know we have some purists here. And that's considered the holy writing for English-speaking people. The Yoma is the tractate, the section of the Mishnah. Yoma stands for the day. When you say to a Jew, the day, we are celebrating the day, they mean one thing, this day. There is no other day. This is that important to them. But at the time of Jesus Christ, I'd like you to listen to this codification of the oral law and what atonement had developed. And as you listen, I want you to remember the phrase, teaching for doctrines, the commandments of men. Yoma, the Day of Atonement begins. 7 days before the Day of Atonement, the high priest was taken apart from his own house under the counselor's chamber, and another priest was made ready in his stead, lest he should befall and he be rendered ineligible. Rabbi Judah says, also another wife was made ready for him, lest his own wife should die. For it is written, he shall make atonement for himself and his house. His house means his wife. They said to him, if so, there would be no end to the matter. Therefore, he shall have a surrogate wife. Throughout the 7 days, he must toss blood and burn incense, train and trim the lamps, and offer the head and the hind leg. But on other days, he offers only if he is minded to offer. For the high priest has first place in offering the offerings. He has first place in taking a portion. Throughout the 7 days, and I'm skipping over page after page here. Throughout the 7 days, they did not withhold food and drink from him. This is preparatory to the Day of Atonement. They did not withhold food from him. But on the eve of the Day of Atonement, in the daylight portion, toward nightfall, they did not suffer him to eat, since food induces sleep. The elders of the court delivered him to the elders of the priesthood, and they brought him up to the upper chamber to the house of Abtinus. They adjured him and took their leave and went their way. My Lord High Priest, they said, we are delegates of the court, and you are our delegate and the delegate of the court. We adjure you by him that made his name to dwell in this house, meaning God, that you change not of what we have said to you. You shall speak as you have been told. He turned aside and wept, and they turned aside and wept. If he had sought to slumber, young members of the priesthood would snap their middle finger before him and say, my Lord High Priest, get up. Drive away sleep this once. Walk upon the cold pavement outside. Every day they used to remove the ashes from off the altar at cockcrow or near to it, either before it or after it. But on the Day of Atonement at midnight and on the feast at the first watch, and therefore the time of the cockcrow drew near the temple court was filled with Israelites. It goes on and on and on. None may enter the temple court for an act of the temple service, even though he is clean until he has immersed himself. On this day, the high priest 5 times immerses himself, and 10 times he washes his hands and his feet. each time excepting this alone in the temple of the chamber. This is what it had developed into at the time of Jesus Christ. This is the Day of Atonement when Jesus Christ was at the temple. This is what all of Israel saw at this time. There had fear and dread had developed. Would he say the right words? Would the high priest forget what to do in the right order? Exactly. Would the high priest emerge from his office and his duties? Would the sacrifice be accepted for him, for the people? Would we all die? Blood and smoke and smell. Yeah, tremendous drama. And it had been added to and added to and made more and more complex. Now, at this point, I'm going to make my hard right turn. It's just a small scenic side road in this journey that we're on right now. I promise, we'll get back to the main course. But this is where Perry Mason comes in. Now, for those of you under 30, how many of you know who Perry Mason was or is? To me, it's who he is. Come on, the show. Perry Mason, how many of you have heard of Perry Mason? There we go, that's the better question. Good. Well, for the three of you who have never heard of Perry Mason, it was a series on TV in the late 1950s and early 60s. It was a defense attorney, criminal law attorney in Los Angeles. And in 9 years, I bet right now you're wondering, how is he going to tie this in? It'll be a stretch, but say a little prayer that you hope it works. But in 9-10 years of the season of seasons and 271 episodes, of which the Garnets have all, I'll take that as a friendly laugh, not a mocking laugh. He lost one time. And even then, he won the case later. He rewon it. So he has a perfect record. 271 successful cases tried. And yet every week as I laid in bed on Sunday night, because I wasn't allowed to watch it when I was a small child, my mom and dad and millions of other Americans would sit and tune in to see one thing. Would he lose? Now, I have a question for you. He never did, but they tuned in to see if he would lose. I have a question for you. Don't you think after maybe 5 or 10, maybe 15 shows, they'd kind of get the idea he's not losing? Do you think a trend would have emerged, you know? To a normal human being, what's the definition of insanity? Doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. But for 9 years, hundreds of cases, people tuned in. Is he ever going to lose, I wonder, tonight? Maybe tonight's the night he'll lose a case. He did not. They changed nights. They said, on Thursday nights, maybe he'll start losing. And I remember when they interviewed the lead actor, they said, Mr. Burr, Perry Mason wins every case. The district attorney never, ever wins. He says, well, we don't show the cases that appear on Tuesdays. He wins on those. He never lost. This situation became so popular that they coined this phrase, the Perry Mason syndrome. It's actually a psychological concept where Americans at that time had preconceptions about American legal system. The point was he never lost. Never ever. Yet millions tuned in to see exactly that he would lose. And so it is, as you may know, with several TV shows. Same thing over and over and over again. I know today I don't watch a lot of series on TVs, because they want clouded endings. But the shows we used to watch, we knew who was the good guys, we knew who the bad guys. We knew right and wrong, and the show did too. Now you're thinking, what in the world does Perry Mason have to do with the Day of Atonement? Let me try and tie it up. After 14 centuries, 1400 years, with many starts and stops, I will admit, as Israel did not, but mainly kept the holy days, atonement was among them. The high priest was never killed on the Day of Atonement. We have no record that the high priest ever did not make it out. And yet, there was this fear. He always emerged, every time. The sacrifices were always accepted on the Day of Atonement, for we have no record, in the Bible at least, we may in secular literature, that they weren't ever accepted. And next year it was repeated. And the next year it was repeated. Year after year after year. The reason is different. The reason was it had to be done. This is the way atonement or expiation of sins had to be done. But what's interesting, I think interesting, was this fear of getting it wrong. The fear of the priest dying. And we say, how did it morph into what we read in the Mishnah about the Day of Atonement? How did it become more complex, more and more involved and detailed and more drama? The answer is simple. It's because of human beings. They're involved. They're human beings and they commit sin. All God wanted his people to do then, as he does now, he wants his people to obey him. And they don't. He does not want sacrifice. Excuse me. He wants his people to stop sinning. At least stop sinning so rapidly. During those years, God's prophets over and over and over again, and I'm going to reference some, and you may turn to them if you wish. His prophets tried to get God's people to understand and to listen. The prophet Samuel says, does the Eternal delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. Proverbs says, do what is right and just. It is more acceptable to the Lord than any sacrifice. Hosea says, God desires mercy and not sacrifice. More, he says, know me. I want that more than burnt offerings. The prophet we know as Jesus in the New Testament repeats it twice in Matthew and again in Mark. And yet, God's people still sin. They still sin. And therefore, we need a sacrifice. Wouldn't this all be solved? No more days of atonement. Figuratively, spiritually, literally, ever. If God's people stop sinning. How about if we just slowed down a little bit in sinning? Kind of got it down to maybe 30 miles an hour. Instead of 120 to 150 miles an hour, could we even slow down? I don't think we can do that either. God's still desire, however, and what this day pictures, God still desires that we meet him behind the veil. His intent and his objective is to meet us face to face. So I have another set of series of questions for you. What if there was a perfect sacrifice? Not bulls or goats or rams. What if there was a perfect high priest that could not die? He was immortal. He cannot and could not die. That his actions were perfect. All that he said and did was perfect. Someone who could represent all the people for all time, through all centuries, all millennia. What about that? Think that'd work? Think that might be a solution? So we have these three perspectives, three aspects on the Day of Atonement. Through all the beautiful pageantry, the beautiful series of events that we know so well, if we've been in the church, if it is new to you, it is a beautiful ceremony. It's meant to do good. It's meant to help God's people so that God and man can meet and be at one. The atonement for sins of the people, the work of the physical high priest, and the removal of sin. Those three things are paramount among all the many, many different aspects, including a fast to make us ever more humble. But we also saw how this very simple and beautiful ceremony, as toilsome as it was for the high priest, we saw how it had changed and become increasingly complex, more of a dread and a fear. But what if there was something better? Turn with me, if you would, to the New Testament, to a writer that knows this ceremony so very, very well, the book of Hebrews. And Hebrews is probably one of the best sources that we pick on this Day of Atonement, because it's about the Day of Atonement. And it's about this, the person that answers all the questions that I put to you, that this one person could fulfill. So in chapter 9 and verse 1, the writer of Hebrews, who many think is Paul, begins, "Then indeed, even the first covenant had ordinances of divine service and the earthly sanctuary." Now picture what we read in Leviticus 16. "For a tabernacle was prepared, the first part in which there was the lampstand, the table, the showbread, which is called the sanctuary, and behind the second veil, the part of the tabernacle which is called the holiest of all, or the holy of holies, which had the golden censer and the ark of the covenant overlaid on all sides with gold, in which were the golden pot that had the manna, Aaron's rod that budded, the tablets of the covenant, and above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. But of these things we cannot speak in detail." And the reason is, it was gone. The tabernacle was gone. The ark of the covenant was gone. All the utensils of the temple and the tabernacle were gone. So they could not speak in detail of it. But they read Leviticus chapter 16. They read the law every year. They knew exactly what it looked like. They just couldn't see it because it wasn't there anymore. But they had this memory. All that was left for the writer of Hebrews was the temple. The temple that had been built up to the beginning of the last century, beginning of the first century. And so he moves on in chapter 10. He gets more specific. In chapter 10, and we begin in verse 19. I think it might be helpful if I got to the right chapter. There we go. He says, "Therefore, brethren, having boldness to enter the holiest of all, the holy of holies, by the blood of Jesus Christ, by a new and living way, which he consecrated for us through the veil, that is, his flesh, and having a high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart, in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water." Notice the words that are used here throughout. The sprinkling, the washing. It reminds us of what? Leviticus 16. Our bodies washed with pure water. Baptism. Verse 23. "Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider one another in order to stir up," first message, "good works and love, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together." That's why we're assembling here together. "As is the manner of some, but exhorting, encouraging, stirring up one another. And so much more, as you see, by the way, the day approaching." I wonder if the day might not be the Day of Atonement in the future. So we see that Jesus Christ is indeed answers all our questions. Because this historical context and religious context that we have is what we started out with. We said we wanted to see what happened historically in the past, how it had developed. We acknowledge, therefore, the sacrifice and the work of Jesus Christ as the high priest, for he is the only one that can access us to the veil. And so when we do acknowledge this, we technically, in many ways, enact atonement, the Day of Atonement. We are able to meet God behind the veil. It is why we keep this day, to remind us, so we can discuss it. So as Hebrews says, to encourage one another with these words, to stir us up. Again, as the first message said so well, these are the reasons we acknowledge it. So let me leave you with a few last aspects on the Day of Atonement. And in fact, the syndrome that we talked about earlier. We, after 271 episodes, put an equal sign, that's your life. Where God has delivered you and me, proved to you and me, and atoned for our sins. It's an accomplished fact. Every time we prayed, he has forgiven us. Every miracle after miracle, both small and great, in each one of your lives. I have mine, you have yours. And yet, we ask the question, after all this time, isn't it time we trust him? Hasn't he shown he's not going to lose? He will never lose. He went into the temple, he went into the tabernacle in heaven, as Hebrews tells us, one time with his own blood. That shows you the power that this one individual, this high priest, has. Isn't it now time to trust and obey God? To try and stop sinning? And I say this to myself as well as you. Or can we at least slow down a little? But allow me to leave you with this. When we pray, wherever we are, whenever it is, as opposed to what we read in Leviticus, wherever you may be, whatever time of day it may be, when we pray and go to God's throne, we go behind the veil. We go through that veil through the sacrifice and only the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. The Day of Atonement is a remarkable reminder of this incredible fact. And as many atonements as we may have, whether it be 1, 10, or 50, let it never, ever be repetition. Let us always remind ourselves to ask for forgiveness and to repent and to call upon this sacrifice. And let us not doubt or be troubled after all these prayers and all these times. All of us in this room have prayed literally, individually, hundreds, thousands of times. So let us never forget, no matter the time, no matter the hour, no matter the location, that He will always hear, and He has always heard. As was said earlier, Becky and I also wish you a very happy and pleasant and safe and very spiritually rewarding feast season.